Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert A. Heinlein. Continued. Cassette 1, Side 2. Lady, you are about to be offered a bribe.
How big? It'll take quite a chunk to keep me in style the rest of my life in Rio.
Well, you can't expect me to outbid Associated Press or Reuters. How about 100?
What do you think I am?
We settled that. We're dickering over the price. 150?
Look up the number of Associated Press. That's a lamb.
Capital 10-9000. Jill, will you marry me? That's as high as I can go. She looked startled.
What did you say?
Will you marry me? Then when they ride you out of town on a rail, I'll be waiting at the city line and take you away from your sordid existence. You'll come back here and cool your toes in my grass. Our grass, and forget your ignominy. But you've darn well got to sneak me into that room first.
Ben, you almost sound serious. If I phone for a fair witness, will you repeat that?
Caxton sighed. Send for a witness. She stood up.
Ben, she said softly,
I won't hold you to it. She kissed him.
Don't joke about marriage to a spinster.
I wasn't joking.
I wonder. Wipe off the lipstick and I'll tell you everything I know, then we'll consider how you can use it without getting me ridden on that rail. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
She gave him a detailed account. I'm sure he wasn't drugged. I'm equally sure that he was rational, although he talked in the oddest fashion and asked the darndest questions.
It would be odder still if he hadn't talked oddly.
Huh?
Jill, we don't know much about Mars, but we do know that Martians are not human. Suppose you were popped into a tribe so far back in the jungle that they had never seen shoes. Would you know the small talk that comes from a lifetime in a culture? That's a mild analogy. The truth is at least 40 million miles stranger.
Jill nodded. I figured that out. That's why I discounted his odd remarks. I'm not dumb.
No, you're real bright. For a female.
Would you like this martini in your hair?
I apologize. Women are smarter than men. That is proved by our whole setup. Gimme, I'll fill it.
She accepted peace offerings and went on. Ben, that order about not letting him see women, it's silly. He's no sex fiend.
No doubt they don't want to hand him too many shocks at once.
He wasn't shocked. He was just interested. It wasn't like having a man look at me.
If you had granted that request for a viewing, you might have had your hands full.
I don't think so. I suppose they've told him about male and female. He just wanted to see how women are different.
Vive la différence, Caxton answered enthusiastically.
Don't be vulgar.
Me? I was being reverent. I was giving thanks that I was born human and not Martian.
Be serious.
I was never more serious.
Then be quiet. He wouldn't have given me any trouble. You didn't see his face. I did.
What about his face? Jill looked puzzled.
Ben, have you ever seen an angel?
You, cherub? Otherwise not.
Well, neither have I. But that is how he looked. He had old, wise eyes and a completely placid face. A face of unearthly innocence.
She shivered. Unearthly is the word, Ben answered slowly. I'd like to see him.
Ben, why are they keeping him shut up? He wouldn't hurt a fly.
Caxton fitted his fingertips together. Well, they want to protect him. He grew up in Mars gravity. He's probably weak as a cat.
But muscular weakness isn't dangerous. Myasthenia gravis is much worse, and we manage all right with that.
They want to keep him from catching things, too. He's like those experimental animals in Notre Dame. He's never been exposed.
Sure, sure, no antibodies. But from what I hear around the mess hall, Dr. Nelson, the surgeon and the champion, took care of that on the trip back. Mutual transfusions until he had replaced about half his blood tissue.
Can I use that, Jill? That's news.
Just don't quote me. They gave him shots for everything but housemaid's knee, too. But Ben, to protect him from infection doesn't take armed guards.
Jill, I've picked up a few tidbits you may not know. I can't use them because I've got to protect my sources. But I'll tell you. Just don't talk.
I won't.
It's a long story. Want a refill?
No, let's start the steak. Where's the button?
Right here.
Well, push it.
Me? You offered to cook dinner.
Ben Caxton, I will lie here and starve before I will get up to push a button 6 inches from your finger.
As you wish.
He pressed the button.
But don't forget who cooked dinner. Now, about Valentine Michael Smith. There is grave doubt as to his right to the name Smith.
Huh?
Honey, your pal is the first interplanetary bastard of record.
The hell you say?
Please, be ladylike. You remember anything about the envoy? Four married couples. Two couples were Captain and Mrs. Brandt, Doctor and Mrs. Smith. Your friend with the face of an angel is the son of Mrs. Smith by Captain Brandt.
How do they know? And who cares? It's pretty sniveling to dig up scandal after all this time. They're dead. Let them alone.
As to how they know. There probably never were eight people more thoroughly measured and typed. Blood typing, Rh factor, hair and eye color, all those genetic things. You know more about them than I do. It is certain that Mary Jane Lyle Smith was his mother and Michael Brandt his father. It gives Smith a fine heredity. His father had an IQ of 163, his mother 170, and both were tops in their fields. As to who cares, Ben went on, a lot of people care, and more will once this shapes up. Ever heard of the Lyle drive?
Of course, that's what the Champion used.
And every spaceship these days.
Who invented it?
I don't...
Wait a minute. You mean she?
Hand the lady a cigar. Dr. Mary Jane Lyle Smith. She had it worked out before she left, even though development remained to be done. So she applied for basic patents and placed it in trust. Not a non-profit corporation, mind you. Then assigned control and interim income to the Science Foundation. So eventually the government got control. But your friend owns it. It's worth millions, maybe hundreds of millions. I couldn't guess. They brought in dinner. Caxton used ceiling tables to protect his lawn. He lowered one to his chair and another to Japanese height so that Jill could sit on the grass.
Tender?
He asked.
Wonderful, she answered.
Thanks. Remember, I cooked.
Ben,
she said after swallowing,
how about Smith being, illegitimate? Can he inherit?
He's not illegitimate. Dr. Mary Jane was at Berkeley. California laws deny the concept of bastardy. Same for Captain Brandt, as New Zealand has civilized laws. While in the home state of Dr. Ward Smith, Mary Jane's husband, a child born in wedlock is legitimate come hell or high water. We have here, Jill, a man who is the legitimate child of three parents.
Huh?
Now wait, Ben, he can't be. I'm not a lawyer, but...
You sure ain't.
Such fictions don't bother a lawyer. Smith is legitimate different ways in different jurisdictions, even though a bastard in fact. So, he inherits. Besides that, while his mother was wealthy, his fathers were well-to-do. Brandt plowed most of his scandalous salary as a pilot on the moon run into Lunar Enterprises. You know how that stuff boomed. They just declared another stock dividend. Brandt had one vice, gambling, but the bloke won regularly and invested that too. Ward Smith had family money. Smith is heir to both.
Phew!
That ain't half, honey. Smith is heir to the entire crew.
Huh?
All eight signed a Gentleman Adventurers contract, making them mutually heirs to each other, all of them, and their issue. They did it with care, using as models contracts in the 16th and 17th centuries that had stood up against every effort to break them. These were high-powered people. Among them, they had quite a lot. Happened to include considerable Lunar Enterprises stock, too, besides what Brandt held. Smith might own a controlling interest, or at least a key block. Jill thought about the childlike creature who had made such a touching ceremony of a drink of water, and felt sorry for him. Caxton went on.
I wish I could sneak a look at the envoy's log. They recovered it, but I doubt if they'll release it.
Why not, Ben?
It's a nasty story. I got that much before my informant sobered up. Dr. Ward Smith delivered his wife by cesarean section, and she died on the table. What he did next shows that he knew the score. With the same scalpel, he cut Captain Brandt's throat, then his own.
Sorry, hon.
Jill shivered. I'm a nurse. I'm immune to such things.
You're a liar, and I love you for it. I was on police beat 3 years, Jill. I never got hardened to it.
What happened to the others?
If we don't break the bureaucrats loose from that log, we'll never know. And I'm a starry-eyed newsboy who thinks we should. Secrecy begets tyranny.
Ben, he might be better off if they gypped him out of his inheritance. He's very, unworldly.
The exact word, I'm sure. Nor does he need money. The man from Mars will never miss a meal. Any government and 1,000-odd universities and institutions would be delighted to have him as a permanent guest.
He'd better sign it over and forget it.
It's not that easy. Jill,
You know the famous case of General Atomics versus Larkin et al.?
You mean the Larkin decision?
I had it in school, same as everybody.
What's it got to do with Smith?
Think back. The Russians sent the first ship to the moon. It crashed. The United States and Canada combined to send one. It gets back, but leaves nobody on the moon. So while the United States and the Commonwealth are getting set to send a colonizing one under the sponsorship of the Federation, and Russia is mounting the same deal on their own, General Atomics steals a march by boosting one from an island, leased from Ecuador, and their men are there sitting pretty and looking smug when the Federation vessel shows up, followed by the Russian one. So General Atomics, a Swiss corporation, American-controlled, claimed the moon. The Federation couldn't brush them off and grab it. The Russians wouldn't have held still. So the High Court ruled that a corporate person, a mere legal fiction, could not own a planet. The real owners were the men who maintained occupation, Larkin and Associates. So they recognized them as a sovereign nation and took them into the Federation, with melon slicing for those on the inside and concessions to General Atomics and its daughter corporation, Lunar Enterprises. This did not please anybody, and the Federation High Court was not all-powerful then, but it was a compromise everybody could swallow. It resulted in rules for colonizing planets, all based on the Larkin decision, and intended to avoid bloodshed. Worked, too. World War III did not result from conflict over space travel and such. So the Larkin decision is law, and applies to Smith. Jill shook her head.
I don't see the connection.
Think, Jill. By our laws, Smith is a sovereign nation, and sole owner of the planet Mars. Chapter 5. Jill looked round-eyed.
Too many martinis, Ben. I would swear you said that patient owns Mars.
He does. He occupied it the required period. Smith is the planet Mars, king, president, sole civic body, what you will. If the champion had not left colonists, Smith's claim might have lapsed, but it did. And that continues occupation even though Smith came to Earth. But Smith doesn't have to split with them. They are mere immigrants until he grants them citizenship.
Fantastic.
But legal. Honey, you see why people are interested in Smith, and why the administration is keeping him under a rug? What they are doing isn't legal. Smith is also a citizen of the United States and of the Federation. It's illegal to hold a citizen, even a convicted criminal, incommunicado anywhere in the Federation. Also, it has been an unfriendly act all through history to lock up a visiting monarch, which he is, and not to let him see people, especially the press, meaning me. You still won't sneak me?
Huh? You've got me scared silly, Ben. If they had caught me, what would they have done?
Nothing rough. Locked you in a padded cell with a certificate signed by 3 doctors and allowed you mail on alternate leap years. I'm wondering what they're going to do to him.
What can they do?
Well, he might die. From G-fatigue, say.
You mean murder him?
Tut, tut. Don't use nasty words. I don't think they will. In the first place, he's a mine of information. In the second place, he's a bridge between us and the only other civilized race we have encountered. How are you on the classics? Ever read H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds?
A long time ago in school.
Suppose the Martians turn out nasty. They might, and we have no way of guessing how big a club they swing. Smith might be the go-between who could make the first interplanetary war unnecessary. Even if this is unlikely, the administration can't ignore it. The discovery of life on Mars is something that, politically, they haven't figured out yet.
Then you think he is safe?
For the time being. The Secretary General has to guess right. As you know, his administration is shaky.
I don't pay attention to politics.
You should. It's barely less important than your own heartbeat.
I don't pay attention to that either.
Don't talk when I'm orating. The patchwork majority headed by Douglas could slip apart overnight. Pakistan would bolt at a nervous cough. There would be a vote of no confidence, and Mr. Secretary General Douglas would go back to being a cheap lawyer. The man from Mars can make or break him.
Are you going to sneak me in? I'm going to enter a nunnery. Is there more coffee?
I'll see. They stood up. Jill stretched and said,
Oh, my ancient bones. Never mind coffee, Ben. I've got a hard day tomorrow. Run me home, will you?
Or send me home. That's safer. Okay. Though the evening is young. He went into his bedroom, came out carrying an object the size of a small cigarette lighter. You won't sneak me in?
Cheap, Ben. I want to, but...
Never mind. It is dangerous. And not just to your career. He showed her the object. Will you put a bug on him?
Huh? What is it? The greatest boon to spies since the Mickey Finn. A micro-miniaturized recorder. The wire is spring-driven, so it can't be spotted by a snooper circuit. The insides are packed in plastic. You could drop it out of a cab. The power is about as much radioactivity as in a watch dial, but shielded. The wire runs 24 hours, then you slide out a spool and stick in another. The spring is part of the spool.
Will it explode? She asked nervously.
You could bake it in a cake.
Ben, you've got me scared to go into his room.
You can go into the room next door, can't you?
I suppose so.
This thing has donkey's ears. Fasten the concave side against a wall. Tape will do, and it picks up everything in the room beyond.
I'm bound to be noticed if I duck in and out of that room. Ben, his room has a wall in common with a room on another corridor. Will that do?
Perfect. You'll do it?
Give it to me. I'll think it over.
Caxton polished it with his handkerchief. Put on your gloves.
Why?
Possession is good for a vacation behind bars. Use gloves, and don't get caught with it.
You think of the nicest things.
Want to back out? Jill let out a long breath.
No.
Good girl. A light blinked. He glanced up. That must be your cab. I rang for it when I went to get this.
Oh. Now find my shoes, will you? Don't come to the roof. The less I'm seen with you, the better.
As you wish. As he straightened up from putting her shoes on, she took his head in both hands and kissed him.
Dear Ben, no good can come of this, and I hadn't realized you were a criminal. But you're a good cook as long as I set the combination. I might marry you if I can trap you into proposing again.
The offer remains open.
Do gangsters marry their molls, or is it frails?
She left hurriedly.
Jill placed the bug easily. The patient in the room in the next corridor was bedfast. Jill often stopped to gossip. She stuck it against the wall over a closet shelf while chattering about how the maids just never dusted the shelves.
Changing spools the next day was easy. The patient was asleep. She woke while Jill was perched on a chair. Jill diverted her with a spicy ward rumor. Jill sent the exposed wire by mail, as the postal system seemed safer than a cloak-and-dagger ruse. But her attempts to insert a third spool, she muffed. She waited for the patient to be asleep, but had just mounted the chair when the patient woke.
Oh, hello, Miss Boardman.
Jill froze.
Hello, Mrs. Fritchley, she managed to answer. Have a nice nap?
Fair,
the woman answered peevishly.
My back aches.
I'll rub it.
Doesn't help. Why are you always fiddling in my closet? Is something wrong?
Jill tried to re-swallow her stomach.
Mice,
she answered.
Mice? Oh, I'll have to have another room.
Jill tore the instrument loose and stuffed it into her pocket. Jumped down.
Now, Mrs. Fritchley, I was just looking to see if there were mouse holes. There aren't.
You're sure?
Quite sure. Now let's rub the back. Easy over.
Jill decided to risk the empty room, which was part of K-12, the suite of the man from Mars. She got the pass key, only to find the room unlocked and holding two more Marines. The guard had been doubled. One looked around as she opened the door. Looking for someone?
No. Don't sit on the bed, boys, she said crisply. If you need chairs, we'll send for them.
The guard got reluctantly up. She left, trying to conceal her trembling. The bug was still in her pocket when she went off duty. She decided to return it to Caxton. Once in the air and headed toward Ben's apartment, she breathed easier. She phoned him in flight. Caxton speaking.
Jill, Ben, I want to see you.
He answered slowly. I don't think it's smart.
Ben, I've got to. I'm on my way.
Well, okay, if that's how it's got to be.
Such enthusiasm.
Now look, hon, it isn't that I...
Bye.
She switched off, calmed down, and decided not to take it out on Ben. They were playing out of their league. At least she was. She should have left politics alone. She felt better when she snuggled into his arms.
Ben was such a dear. Maybe she should marry him.
When she tried to speak, he put a hand over her mouth, whispered, Don't talk. I may be wired. She nodded, got out the recorder, handed it to him. His eyebrows went up, but he made no comment. Instead, he handed her a copy of the Afternoon Post. Seen the paper? He said in a natural voice. You might glance at it while I wash up.
Thanks.
As she took it,
He pointed to a column, then left, taking with him the recorder. The column was Ben's own. The Crow's Nest by Ben Caxton. Everyone knows that jails and hospitals have one thing in common. They can be very hard to get out of. In some ways, a prisoner is less cut off than a patient. A prisoner can send for his lawyer, demand a fair witness, invoke habeas corpus, and require the jailer to show cause in open court. But it takes only a no-visitors sign, ordered by one of the medicine men of our peculiar tribe, to consign a hospital patient to oblivion more thoroughly than ever was the man in the iron mask. To be sure, the patient's next of kin cannot be kept out. But the man from Mars seems to have no next of kin. The crew of the ill-fated Envoy had few ties on Earth. If the man in the iron mask, pardon me, I mean the man from Mars, has any relative guarding his interests, a few thousand reporters have been unable to verify it. Who speaks for the man from Mars? Who ordered an armed guard placed around him? What is his dread disease that no one may glimpse him nor ask him a question? I address you, Mr. Secretary General. The explanation about physical weakness and G-fatigue won't wash. If that were the answer, a 90-pound nurse would do as well as an armed guard. Could this disease be financial in nature? Or, let's say it softly, is it political? There was more of the same. Jill could see that Ben was baiting the administration, trying to force them into the open. She felt that Caxton was taking serious risk in challenging the authorities, but she had no notion of the size of the danger, nor what form it might take. She thumbed through the paper. It was loaded with stories on the champion, pictures of Secretary General Douglas pinning medals, interviews with Captain Van Tromp and his brave company, pictures of Martians and Martian cities. There was little about Smith, merely a bulletin that he was improving slowly from the effects of his trip. Ben came out and dropped sheets of onion skin in her lap. Here's another newspaper. He left again. Jill saw that the newspaper was a transcription of what her first wire had picked up. It was marked First Voice, Second Voice, and so on. But Ben had written in names wherever he had been able to make attributions. He had written across the top, "All voices are masculine." Most items merely showed that Smith had been fed, washed, massaged, and that he had exercised under supervision of a voice identified as Dr. Nelson and one marked Second Doctor. One passage had nothing to do with care of the patient. Jill reread it. Dr. Nelson, how are you feeling, boy? Strong enough to talk? Smith, yes. Dr. Nelson, a man wants to talk to you. Smith, pause. Who? Caxton had written, all of Smith's speeches are preceded by pauses. Nelson, this man is our great, untranscribable, guttural word, Martian. He is our oldest old one. Will you talk with him? Smith, very long pause. I am great happy. The old one will talk, and I will listen and grow. Nelson, no, no, he wants to ask you questions. Smith, I cannot teach an old one. Nelson, the old one wishes it. Will you let him ask you questions? Smith, yes. Background noises. Nelson, this way, sir. I have Dr. Mahmood standing by to translate. Jill read, new voice. Caxton had scratched this out and written in, Secretary General Douglas, 3 exclamation points. Secretary General.
I won't need him. You say Smith understands English?
Nelson. Well, yes and no, Your Excellency. He knows a number of words, but as Mahmood says, he doesn't have any cultural context to hang them on. It can be confusing. Secretary General.
Oh, we'll get along, I'm sure. When I was a youngster, I hitchhiked all through Brazil without a word of Portuguese when I started. Now, if you will introduce us, then leave us alone.
Nelson.
Sir, I had better stay with my patient.
Secretary General.
Really, Doctor? I'm afraid I must insist. Sorry.
Nelson.
And I'm afraid that I must insist. Sorry, sir, medical ethics.
Secretary General, interrupting.
As a lawyer, I know something of medical jurisprudence, so don't give me that medical ethics mumbo-jumbo. Did this patient select you?
Nelson.
Not exactly. But,
Secretary General,
has he had the opportunity to choose physicians? I doubt it. His status is ward of the state. I am acting as next of kin de facto, and you will find de jure as well. I wish to interview him alone.
Nelson. Long pause, then very stiffly.
If you put it that way, Your Excellency, I withdraw from the case.
Secretary General.
Don't take it that way, Doctor. I'm not questioning your treatment. But you wouldn't try to keep a mother from seeing her son alone now, would you? Are you afraid I might hurt him?
Nelson.
No, but...
Secretary General.
Then what is your objection? Come now, introduce us and let's get on with it. The fussing may be upsetting your patient.
Nelson.
Your Excellency, I will introduce you. Then you must select another doctor for your... ward.
Secretary General.
I'm sorry, Doctor, I really am. I can't take that as final. We'll discuss it later. Now, if you please.
Nelson. Step over here, sir. Son, this is the man who wants to see you, our great old one. Smith. Untranscribable. Secretary General.
What did he say?
Nelson. A respectful greeting. Mahmoud says it translates. I am only an egg. More or less that, anyway. It's friendly.
Son, talk man talk.
Smith.
Yes.
Nelson.
And you had better use simple words if I may offer a last advice.
Secretary General.
Oh, I will.
Nelson.
Goodbye, Your Excellency.
Goodbye, son.
Secretary General.
Thanks, Doctor. See you later.
Secretary General continued.
How do you feel?
Smith.
Feel fine.
Secretary General.
Good. Anything you want, just ask for it. We want you to be happy. Now, I have something I want you to do for me. Can you write?
Smith.
Write.
What is
write?
Secretary General.
Well, your thumbprint will do. I want to read a paper to you. This paper has a lot of lawyer talk, but stated simply, it says you agree that in leaving Mars, you have abandoned, I mean, given up any claims that you may have there. Understand me? You assign them in trust to the government.
Smith.
No answer.
Secretary General.
Well, let's put it this way. You don't own Mars, do you?
Smith.
Longish pause.
I do not understand.
Secretary General.
Let's try again. You want to stay here, don't you?
Smith.
I do not know. I was sent by the old ones.
Long, untranscribable speech. Sounds like a bullfrog fighting a cat. Secretary General.
Damn it, they should have taught him more English by now. See here, son, you don't have to worry. Just let me have your thumbprint at the bottom of this page. Let me have your right hand. No, don't twist around that way. Hold still. I'm not going to hurt you. Doctor! Dr. Nelson!
Second doctor.
Yes, sir?
Secretary General.
Get Dr. Nelson.
Second doctor.
Dr. Nelson? But he left, sir. He said you took him off the case.
Secretary General.
Nelson said that? Damn him! Well, do something. Give him artificial respiration. Give him a shot. Don't just stand there. Can't you see the man is dying?
Second doctor.
I don't believe there's anything to be done, sir. Just let him alone until he comes out of it. That's what Dr. Nelson always did.
Secretary General.
Blast Dr. Nelson.
The Secretary General's voice did not appear again, nor that of Dr. Nelson. Jill could guess, from gossip she had picked up, that Smith had gone into one of his cataleptiform withdrawals. There were two more entries. One read, "No need to whisper, he can't hear you." The other read, "Take that tray away. We'll feed him when he comes out of it." Jill was rereading it when Ben reappeared. He had more onion skin sheets, but he did not offer them. Instead, he said,
"Hungry?"
"Starved."
"Let's go shoot a cow."
He said nothing while they went to the roof and took a taxi, still kept quiet during the flight to Alexandria platform where they switched cabs. Ben picked one with a Baltimore number. Once in the air, he set it for Hagerstown, Maryland, then relaxed.
Now we can talk.
Ben, why the mystery?
Sorry, Prettyfoots. I don't know that my apartment is bugged, but if I can do it to them, they can do it to me.
Likewise, while it isn't likely that a cab signaled from my flat would have an ear in it, still it might have. The special service squads are thorough. But this cab, he patted its cushions, they can't gimmick thousands of cabs. One picked at random should be safe.
Jill shivered. Ben, you don't think they would...
She let it trail off.
Don't I now?
You saw my column. I filed that copy 9 hours ago. You think the administration will let me kick it in the stomach without kicking back?
But you have always opposed this administration.
That's okay. This is different. I have accused them of holding a political prisoner. Jill, a government is a living organism. Like every living thing, its prime characteristic is the instinct to survive. You hit it, it fights back. This time I've really hit it, he added. But I shouldn't have involved you.
I'm not afraid. Not since I turned that gadget back to you.
You're associated with me. If things get rough, that could be enough.
Jill shut up. The notion that she, who had never experienced worse than a spanking as a child, and an occasional harsh word as an adult, could be in danger, was hard to believe. As a nurse, she had seen the consequences of ruthlessness, but it could not happen to her. Their cab was circling for a landing before she broke the moody silence. Ben, suppose this patient dies. What happens?
Huh?
He frowned.
That's a good question. If there are no other questions, class is dismissed.
Don't be funny.
Jill, I've been awake nights trying to answer that. Here are the best answers I have. If Smith dies, his claim to Mars vanishes. Probably the group the champion left on Mars starts a new claim, and almost certainly the administration worked out a deal before they left Earth. The champion is a Federation ship, but it is possible that such a deal leaves all strings in the hands of Secretary General Douglas. That could keep him in power a long time. On the other hand, it might mean nothing at all.
Huh? Why?
The Larkin decision might not apply. Luna was uninhabited, but Mars is, by Martians. At the moment, Martians are a legal zero, but the High Court might take a look at the political situation and decide that human occupancy meant nothing on a planet inhabited by non-humans. Then rights on Mars would have to be secured from the Martians.
But, Ben, that would be the case anyhow. This notion of a single man owning a planet, it's fantastic.
Don't use that word to a lawyer. Straining at gnats and swallowing camels is a required course in law schools. Besides, there is precedent. In the 15th century, the Pope deeded the Western Hemisphere to Spain and Portugal, and nobody cared that the real estate was occupied by Indians with their own laws, customs, and property rights. His grant was effective, too. Look at a map and notice where Spanish is spoken and where Portuguese is spoken.
Yes, but, Ben, this isn't the 15th century.
It is to a lawyer, Jill. If the High Court rules that the Larkin decision applies, Smith is in a position to grant concessions which may be worth millions, more likely billions. If he assigns his claim to the administration, then Secretary Douglas controls the plums.
Ben, why should anybody want that much power?
Why does a moth fly toward light? But Smith's financial holdings are almost as important as his position as nominal King Emperor of Mars. The High Court could knock out his squatter's rights, but I doubt if anything could shake his ownership of the Lyell Drive and a chunk of Lunar Enterprises. What happens if he dies? 1,000 alleged cousins would pop up, of course. But the Science Foundation has fought off such money-hungry vermin for years. It seems possible that, if Smith dies without a will, his fortune reverts to the state.
Do you mean the Federation or the United States?
Another question to which I have no answer. His parents come from two countries of the Federation, and he was born outside them all. And it will make a crucial difference to some people who votes that stock and licenses those patents. It won't be Smith. He won't know a stock proxy from a traffic ticket. It is likely to be whoever can grab him and hang on. I doubt if Lloyd's would insure his life. He strikes me as a poor risk.
The poor baby. The poor, poor infant.
Chapter 6. The restaurant in Hagerstown had atmosphere. Tables scattered over a lawn leading down to a lake, and more tables in the boughs of three enormous trees. Jill wanted to eat in a tree, but Ben bribed the maitre d'hotel to set up a table near the water, then ordered a stereo tank placed by it. Jill was miffed.
Ben, why pay these prices if we can't eat in the trees and have to endure that horrible jitterbox?
Patience, little one. Tables in trees have microphones. They have to have them for service. This table is not gimmicked, I hope, as I saw the waiter take it from a stack. As for the tank, not only is it un-American to eat without stereo, but the racket will interfere with a directional mic, if Mr. Douglas's investigators are taking an interest.
Do you really think they're shadowing us, Ben?
Jill shivered.
I'm not cut out for a life of crime.
Pish and likewise tush. When I was in the General Synthetic scandals, I never slept twice in one place and ate nothing but packaged food. You get to like it. Stimulates the metabolism.
My metabolism doesn't need it. All I require is one elderly, wealthy patient.
Not going to marry me, Jill?
After my future husband kicks off, yes.
Or maybe I'll be so rich I can keep you as a pet.
How about starting tonight?
After he kicks off.
During the dinner, the musical show, which had been banging their eardrums, stopped. An announcer's head filled the tank. He smiled and said, NWNW, New World Networks, and its sponsor, Wise Girl Malthusian Lozenges, is honored to surrender time for a history-making broadcast by the Federation government. Remember, friends, every wise girl uses Wise Girls. Easy to carry, pleasant to take, guaranteed no fail, and approved for sale without prescription under Public Law 1312. Why take a chance on old-fashioned, unaesthetic, harmful, unsure methods? Why risk losing his love and respect? The lovely lupine announcer glanced aside and hurried the commercial. I give you the wise girl, who in turn brings you the Secretary General. The 3D picture cut to a young woman, so sensuous, so mammalian, so seductive, as to make any male unsatisfied with local talent. She stretched and wiggled and said in a bedroom voice, I always use wise girl. The picture dissolved and an orchestra played, Hail to Sovereign Peace. Ben said, Do you use wise girl? None of your business. Jill looked ruffled and added, It's a quack nostrum. Anyhow, what makes you think I need it? Caxton did not answer. The tank had filled with the fatherly features of Secretary General Douglas.
Friends, he began, fellow citizens of the Federation, I have tonight a unique honor and privilege. Since the triumphant return of our trailblazing champion.
He continued to congratulate the citizens of Earth on their successful contact with another planet, another race. He managed to imply that the exploit was the personal accomplishment of every citizen, that any one of them could have led the expedition had he not been busy with serious work, and that he, Secretary Douglas, had been their humble instrument to work their will. The notions were never stated baldly, the assumption being that the common man was the equal of anyone, and better than most, and that good old Joe Douglas embodied the common man. Even his mussed cravat and cowlicked hair had a just folks quality. Ben Caxton wondered who had written it. Jim Sanforth, probably. Jim had the slickest touch of any of Douglas's staff in selecting loaded adjectives to tickle and soothe. He had written commercials before he went into politics and had no compunctions. Yes, that bit about the hand that rocks the cradle was Jim's work. Jim was the type who would entice a young girl with candy. Turn it off, Jill demanded.
Quiet, pretty foots. I must hear this. And so, friends, I have the honor to bring you our fellow citizen, Valentine Michael Smith, the man from Mars. Mike, we know you are tired and have not been well, but will you say a few words to your friends?
The stereo scene cut to a semi-close of a man in a wheelchair. Hovering over him was Douglas, and on the other side was a nurse, stiff, starched, and photogenic. Jill gasped. Ben whispered, Keep quiet. The smooth baby face of the man in the chair broke into a shy smile. He looked at the camera and said, Hello, folks. Excuse me for sitting down. I'm still weak. He seemed to speak with difficulty, and once the nurse took his pulse. In answer to questions from Douglas, he paid compliments to Captain Van Tromp and his crew, thanked everyone for his rescue, and said that everyone on Mars was terribly excited over contact with Earth, and that he hoped to help in welding friendly relations between the two planets. The nurse interrupted, but Douglas said gently,
Mike, do you feel strong enough for one more question?
Sure, Mr. Douglas, if I can answer it.
Mike, what do you think of the girls here on Earth?
Gee!
The baby face looked awestruck and ecstatic and turned pink. The scene cut to head and shoulders of the Secretary Douglas.
Mike asked me to tell you, he went on in fatherly tones, that he will be back to see you as soon as he can. He has to build up his muscles, you know. Possibly next week, if the doctors say he is strong enough.
The scene shifted to wise girl lozenges, and a playlet made clear that a girl who did not use them was not only out of her mind, but a syntho in the hay. Men would cross the street to avoid her. Ben switched channels, then turned to Jill and said moodily,
Well, I can tear up tomorrow's column. Douglas has him under his thumb.
Ben.
Huh?
That's not the man from Mars.
What? Baby, are you sure?
Oh, it looked like him,
but he was not the patient I saw in that guarded room. Ben pointed out that dozens of persons had seen Smith. Guards, interns, male nurses, the captain and crew of the Champion, probably others. Quite a few of them must have seen this newscast. The administration would have to assume that some of them would spot a substitution. It did not make sense. Too great a risk. Jill simply stuck out her lower lip and insisted that the person on stereo was not the patient she had met. Finally, she said angrily, "Have it your own way. Men. Now, Jill, please take me home." Ben went for a cab. He did not order one from the restaurant, but selected one from the landing flat of a hotel across the way. Jill remained chilly on the flight back. Ben got out the transcripts and reread them. He thought a while and said, "Jill." "Yes, Mr. Caxton."
"I'll Mister you. Look, Jill, I apologize. I was wrong."
"And what leads you to this conclusion?" He slapped the papers against his palm.
"This. Smith could not have shown this behavior yesterday, and then given that interview tonight. He would have flipped his controls, gone into one of those trance things."
"I am gratified that you have finally seen the obvious."
"Jill, will you kindly kick me, then let up? Do you know what this means?"
"It means they used an actor to fake it. I told you an hour ago."
"Sure, an actor and a good one, carefully typed and coached. But it implies more than that. As I see it, there are two possibilities. The first is that Smith is dead, and..."
"Dead?"
Jill was suddenly back in that curious water-drinking ceremony and felt the strange, warm, unworldly flavor of Smith's personality. Felt it with unbearable sorrow. "Maybe. In which case, this ringer will stay alive as long as they need him. Then the ringer will die, and they will ship him out of town with a hypnotic injunction so strong he would choke up with asthma if he tried to spill it. Or maybe even a lobotomy. But if Smith is dead, we can forget it. We'll never prove the truth. So let's assume he's alive."
"Oh, I hope so.
What is Hecuba to you, or you to Hecuba?" Caxton misquoted. "If he is alive, it could be that there's nothing sinister about it.